Well, I must thank you because I've just lost my ticket. I've got my return ticket, but as a ticket inspector came up to me and said, "Tickets, please," he saw yourself, one of four Buddhist monks, enter the train and was very excited to go over and check your tickets. What's your name?
My name is Jayanta Bhikkhu.
And you are based in the UK?
Yes.
And you study Buddhism here?
Yeah, I joined the monastic order in Britain, so I learned about Buddhism elsewhere and then came over here 20 years ago.
Wow, so whereabouts did you learn about Buddhism initially?
Various places. My mother in the States was already doing Buddhist meditation, but she wasn't interested in the traditional part of it. She was more in the mind training. And then I traveled when I was at university, took a year off, so I encountered it in Nepal and Tibet and then Thailand. So eventually I came into the Thai tradition, but that was through a sort of coincidental different route.
And it's also a coincidence that you are here. So you're American yourself?
Yes. Yeah.
And you're with three Thai monks?
Yes.
But you didn't intend to be on the train with three Thai monks?
Well, I did intend to be on the train with three Thai monks.
Okay.
But it's a coincidence that we're traveling together because we just happened to have two journeys in London at the same time and we found that out. Yesterday. So.
Excellent. Obviously, in England, you have to pay for your ticket. In Southeast Asia, I remember seeing monks freely travelling all over the country and not having to pay for tickets normally, or getting a discount.
You sometimes get a discount. It depends on the service, yeah. Buses, sometimes the companies will give you a half-price ticket. Plane, Thai Airways will give you half price. And But it's often full price as well. The red buses in Bangkok are free, so that's our freedom pass.
Excellent. A lot of respect in Southeast Asia still for spirituality. Do you find the same kind of respect over here in the UK?
Well, if so, it expresses itself in a different way. So there's not as much... there aren't obviously the same kinds of gestures of worship and conscious articulations of a spiritual interest. But, you know, people are interested in finding meaning in their life, and they're interested in helping the world and looking for something that's a bit deeper. And sometimes that interest, which is itself spiritual, will express itself in different ways. So then it may or may not be so conscious that that's anything to do with what religion can offer. But then, you know, as people are increasingly becoming disillusioned with what the sort of materialistic society has to offer, then there is more and more interest in this sort of path. So the 20 years that I've been involved with the monasteries here, it's very noticeable that more and more people in the society at large, as well as those that come to the monastery, are sort of appreciative of what we're doing rather than nonplussed.
I made a very good friend when I was in Chiang Mai called Tongjam, Golden Moon, I think it means, and he arranged for me to live in the monastery for a while I was teaching English to some of the monks there. Everybody, incredible students, studying incredible qualifications that you would never expect being a layperson just popping by. And he taught me a lot about all kinds of things that I'd never really thought about before. And at the end of maybe 10 years of travel, I came to the conclusion, for me personally, the secret of happiness lied not in the acquisition of more, but maybe developing the capacity to enjoy less. Would you say that sits close with Buddhist beliefs?
Absolutely, yeah. It's a conscious cultivation of contentment is one of the sort of bases for the meditation practice and the whole way of life. And so contentment is a state which will arise naturally. We can't make ourselves be content. But if we know that that's the direction we want to move in, then it can help. Because it's not easy going against the stream of habits and when we start to try to fulfill one desire after another, that creates a kind of momentum that has its own life. And if you're not really conscious of wanting to get out of that momentum, then it's often not going to happen.
So, although I am as guilty as many of being attracted to the shiny objects and the tools which I convince myself are tools of the trade, like this iPhone that I'm using right now and my computer and my motorbike, is the awareness that all of these things aren't really important, and I do feel that many of them are tools and assist me in my job. Is that a step closer to freeing myself as such?
Well, it's sort of about whatever makes you more aware of what's causing your heart to feel dissatisfied. Mm. And so it's not really one step is to have a conscious recognition of these things on a conceptual or philosophical level. That can help. But it can also just be a way that we start to judge ourselves and judge our own desire and, you know, judge these things. They're not, you know, bad in themselves. They're just things. And the difficulty comes in how we relate to them and then the effect that that has on our whole life. So really, it's what's helpful is anything that allows you to see better what's happening. So you want to become aware of what is actually happening more in the present moment, not as a philosophy, but you just see, so, okay, right, interesting, I love this stuff. How does that feel? I love it, you know, delicious, this sort of feeling of, ooh, I can't wait till I get that. And so rather than judge yourself for having that feeling or try to feel a different way, you develop more and more ability to see what's happening as it happens. And then it's more like, so you see that you've been... If you know you're in pain, but you don't know why, and you have all kinds of theories about it and so on, but if you start to see the reason you're in pain is because you're pinching yourself, then you'll be more inclined. First of all, that's good news because you know that there's a solution to it, mm-hmm. and you can kind of see that you have control over the solution. You can stop pinching yourself. And then you can go about learning how to do that, because it seems a simple matter, but actually you can find that your hand's atrophied or you just can't do what you want to do. And so then that's really where the spiritual path starts, I'd say, because you see that there's a problem and you're involved in it, and you want to move towards a solution which will free yourself from suffering. And in doing that, then you help the people you're relating with and the world around you too, because you're able to be more free in your heart with everyone else.
What would you say to the people who would say to you, I'm perfectly happy buying these things, I'm perfectly happy indulging myself in all of these wonderful bits of technology and shiny objects? Would you say that maybe they are kind of trapped in an illusion and fair enough? Or would you say, you know, maybe you should take another look at all of this and see what it's doing to the world and to those around you, and every action has a reaction. And...
Well, everyone, all of us, we're all trapped in an illusion. So it's like we're all in it together.
The Matrix.
Yeah, it's a good image. And so there's different levels of seeing what the illusion is. But it's not a matter of... some people are you can just put it down easily and they're okay, right, everyone else should do that too. It's like realizing, wow, this is we're all stuck in this together, and there is a way out, which is not just getting what I want or making life the way I want it to be, which is normally what all of us assume. You know, things will be good once I get life to be the way I want it to be, or once I get the thing I'm looking for. And so the first lesson can be that, well, that's not actually true. You get the thing you're looking for and it doesn't, you know, you want the next thing, or it changes, or it's not what you thought. It doesn't give you the happiness you assume. Or even life situation is really good, but then you realize it's not as freeing as you would have assumed, because you're busy hoping that it stays this way, trying to protect conditions so that they don't change. And because conditions are always changing and they're not in our control, there's always going to be a tension there, even when things are going well.
I'm always inspired listening to somebody who's practiced in Buddhism, because I always get a sense of there's a lot of sense being talked, and it definitely makes me feel good to hear your words. Could you tell me how many monasteries there are in the UK or places where people can go and learn more about Buddhism?
No, I don't know. I have no idea. But I'm sure a good internet search would give you that information. There's, in terms of our community, we've got four monasteries.
Ah, okay. And what makes your community different from other Buddhist communities?
Well, you know, it's just a matter of the history of it. So there was a particular teacher in Thailand who had disciples, including Western disciples, and some of them came to the UK. So there's actually five in the UK, in fact, I'm realizing, and four of them are sort of sister monasteries, as it were, and one functions a little bit more independently. There are places where people can come. You don't have to want to become a monk or a nun. You can come and stay as a guest. What's your name?
James.
James was just doing.
So James is who's standing with you now is as a guest at your monastery.
He has been for the last week or so. Yeah.
Just a week.
How do you find it?
How did I find the stay?
How was the stay? Was it what you expected?
Oh yeah, I stayed at monasteries in Thailand like yourself before, so it's quite similar to that. Yeah.
A pocket of tranquility in what is otherwise quite a crazy country sometimes.
No, it's surprising what you find. There are places, and there's many more and more Buddhist places these days, so lots of different traditions are represented.
And the name of your Buddhist tradition?
Well, you'd say the Thai forest tradition, which is a sort of subset of the Thai Buddhist scene, monastic tradition. That is part of what's called Theravada Buddhism, which is the sort of what you'd call maybe southern Buddhism as opposed to northern Buddhism, which is Mahayana.
Yeah.
So Mahayana would be Tibet, China, Japan, Korea.
And this is normally recognizable from your robes, which I believe traditionally dyed lighter than the northern Buddhists because their tree roots that they used for dyes were different. Is that right?
We all have the same scriptures pointing to the same sort of colors. But then the Mahayana tradition has developed many, many things which weren't there originally in the Buddha's lifetime. And so maybe that probably affects their color as well.
Okay.
But there's a sort of a range between reddish, yellowish, and brownish, and you'll get this ochre color. You'll see it in different ways in both southern and northern Buddhism.
Well, have a wonderful day wherever you're going, and thank you very, very much for talking to me.
Yes, thank you too.